This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book, huh?
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episode 10. Trisha Tanaka is dead. Congratulations, you like Hurley have won cursed money and you have to buy a fast food restaurant chain. What do you own now? My name is Dave Gonzalez and I own a Colorado-based burger chain called Good Times Burgers and Fries now, because I'm going to act locally.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and since I am from California, I'm legally required to say in and out. But get this, I will take all of the Jesus stuff off the containers. So we will have Christ-free food at In-N-Out going forward. Non-denominational fries in 2021.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am going to go all the way back to my home state. The state of my birth, Ohio. And like any good Ohioan, I would buy something that, has a different state's name. It's called Penn Station. It's a sandwich shop. It's kind of like Quiznos, but like way better. And they have the best fries, French fries of all time. So I would buy one of those and then put it wherever I want to live. So like, I would just like, all right, here's one in Texas and there's one in Portland and who knows.
And then we'll have the Storm fry showdown, non-denominational fry showdown.
Absolutely.
It's the exact reverse of which religion is right, I've decided.
It'll be like the M&M contest.
Exactly.
More perfect. Fun.
If this is your first time joining the show, sorry for all those inside jokes, but you'll be part of them soon. We're a show that's rewatching the ABC series Lost, which aired for 6 seasons. We've been watching one episode a week since season 1, episode 1. We are up to season 3, episode 10. Trisha Tanaka is dead. We split our podcast into sections just in case you have not seen Lost before and this is just a normal watch, not a rewatch for you. If you look down at your notes, you will see The Calm, which is what we call the section without any spoilers. We will only be talking about episodes from season 1, season 2, and season 3 up through episode 10 because that's all we've watched. Then we have an interview this week. Joanna, who are you talking to?
Oh, we are talking to Chief Rolling Stone TV critic Alan Sepinwall, your friend and mine. He joined us for a season 1 episode. He was on our anniversary podcast, but he called dibs on this, our most joyful Lost episode. So we will be hearing from Alan a little later on.
And then after we hear from Alan, we will enter the storm, which is what we call the part of our podcast where we could talk about this episode of Lost in the context of all of Lost. And we also usually have some emails from you guys about greater concepts. It's been fun in the storm. This week, we're returning to our normal layout of calm interview storm. The time codes are in the description. Here we go. But before we start, I have to pause and say thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It really means a lot to us that you're all sticking with us through this tough quarantine time. If you also want to support the podcast, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and you could subscribe for a monthly donation level from $1 and up, I believe. Or did it become $2 and up? Whatever the minimum we made possible.
It's actually $5 and up now.
$5 and up, which is good because at that very bottom level, we have chalked it full with bonus content. It used to just be like, you get in the Slack and you get the podcast. It's fine. Now you get bonus podcasts. You get Slack access. And the bonus podcasts have been heating up in this time of quarantine with feels like the first time. It's Joanna's new, I guess, podcast series with Chris Russo of the Buffering podcast. But recently, Neil and I have been helping out and taking over. And I think we took it to the max with the sword fighting this week. Joanna, what have Neil and I gotten you into?
So, you know, the premise of the podcast is usually like, not that I'm going to use this word. I don't really mean it this way, but like usually Kristen's the dummy, right? In terms of like hasn't seen the thing. And then the guy stepped in and Diana stepped in. Everyone has had their turn playing the dummy. This week, it's my turn to be the dummy. As we go, dun, 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 dun. We're doing Bond, James Bonding. Early Bond is what we're up to. And we're going to be watching on Her Majesty's Secret Service in the Patreon Slack with our listeners this Thursday. If you're listening to this on a Wednesday, tomorrow in the Slack, we'll be watching it. Have we picked a time, folks? Do we want to do so live right now? We'll announce what time later.
There we go.
It'll be at a time.
It'll be at a time on Thursday. We'll be doing that. So yeah, I have never seen a Bond pre-GoldenEye. So that is what we went into. So you will get your feels like the first time pre-watch James Bond episode should already be in your bonus content feed, and then we will do a wrap up. We've got at least one more with the three of us scheduled for July, and then all things working and the creek don't rise, Kristen will be back. So, and we know, I'll give you a hint as to which franchise Kristen has requested to come back on. It involves very buff lady arms. So you can try to figure out what that is. It is a very famous franchise and we will be coming back on that. So that feels like the first time. Just one of many like bonus perks you can get if you join patreon.com/stormofspoilers. Obviously, hanging out with us in the Slack is not the only way to get in touch with us. You can also email us, host@stormpodcast.com. You can go to stormpodcast.com, our website, and check out our schedule, what we've got going on. You can find us on Twitter @stormpodcast, or you can write us a review. We love those as well. I'm going to start off with a quick review from WoollyWoo24, who wrote 5 stars. Even my non-podcast listening boyfriend likes this podcast. I've personally been a longtime listener of this podcast, and I personally feel that it just keeps getting better with time. When they started covering Lost, I had to go back and rewatch the show, showing it to my boyfriend for the first time. We couldn't control ourselves and have since finished the series, but we still take the time to listen to this podcast each week. Joanna, Dave, and Neil have a great rapport, even when they disagree on things. The insides are fascinating, and the discourse is also funny and entertaining. I'm a particular fan of Joanna's interviews. She asks great questions. Overall, great and very engaging podcast. Thank you, Willy Woo. I appreciate you. And thank you all for all your kind words you said about our Biling interview last week. That was a wild ride, and I bless you all for going on it with us. It was really fun. And then we just have a couple quick emails. This one's from Andrew, who writes in Stranger in a Strange Land clarification is titled the email. I want to write this and offer this as a possible look at some of the questions you had during the last episode. You all... in parentheses, everybody, seemed confused as to the meaning of Jack's tattoos. You seem to really be struggling to find the words and connections to justify his tattoos. While it doesn't necessarily help the story of the episode, I think the tattoo has to do with Jack's place as a leader. He walks amongst us, but he is not one of us, seems to usually be taken as an allusion to his place with the people of Thailand or with the others, but... Achara, when asked to use her gift on Jack, speaks of his leadership and the loneliness that it brings. This, to me, has always been what his tattoo is referring to, much like a captain of a ship during the rise of the British Empire would never fraternize with his crew, as it would make things more difficult to order them to do potentially deadly things. This can be applied to Jack, albeit lazily, as he does in the series, one it both ways at times. I would elaborate more, but you asked us to keep these emails shorter. I will simply add that I love this show and the hosts, except Joanna, because she looks at the world and sees the lack of equality given to people of color, people of different genders, people often left behind in society, and points that out, and how we should as a group see it with her and make changes to better life for those people, and as a byproduct, we'll make better lives for ourselves, and I don't like that. JK, I'm an enormous fan of Joanna, but it seems that all anyone does in an email or five-star review is hate on her, and I didn't want to not hit that spot on the podcast bingo card. So thank you, Andrew, for your...
I went through a roller coaster of reactions just in that paragraph.
You really did earn that bingo.
I was like reading it, and I like clenched, and then I unclenched. I was like, what the... Oh, okay. And then this email comes from Chris. Also about the, he walks amongst us, but he is not one of us, in Stranger in a Strange Land. Chris, really likes this episode, because he was, really bullied. And he said he walked away from his group of friends because they were bullies and they grew up to become people who considered racism to not be only acceptable, but humorous. Loss is among the many things that helped me process this difficult life choice afterwards, specifically the energy surrounding Don't Tell Me What I Can't Do, and of course, he walks amongst us, but he is not one of us. Maybe it was just the Michael Giacchino score behind it, but the phrase gave me solace to the point where I may have even considered getting the tattoo myself, if not for the fact that that tattoo in reality means something entirely different. Anyways, I guess because of this, Stranger in Strange Land will always carry a higher significance for me than I suspect it probably deserves. I write in because it feels a bit comforting for me to be reminded of this episode now, 10 years later, given the current social climate that we all find ourselves in today surrounding race. This trip down memory lane would not have likely happened without this rewatch in your podcast, and for that I thank you, our hosts. Please keep up the good work and get you not falling down. So that's Chris from New Orleans finding actual positive racial representation or reminders in Stranger in a Strange Land, which is a different point of view. And this last email comes from Demetris, who's written to us before, and this is just like a little shout out. Demetris says, please send a shout out to Marina, my wife, on her name day. She hates my obsession with Lost and your podcast, and I figured this might make her day. And then he says,
bold.
And then he said, P.S. the episode Stranger in a Strange Land is one of my favorites. So, there we go.
So there's just like a lot of conflict going on in that house around our podcast.
So those are our emails. We don't have any spoiler ones this week. Please do continue just to send us like stormy emails if you want us to discuss complications of time travel or whatever the case may be. There was like a sort of raging debate about the redacted. I can't even say, no, we can say this. What happened to, I'm going to ask you a question. You're going to answer me in a spoiler-free way. What happened to Russo's people? Neil and Dave?
They got sick and she killed them?
Sickness. There was a whole debate about that in our storm section of our Slack this week that I thought was really interesting as people were trying to unpack that. So, if any of them wants to put those thoughts and feelings in an email, we could discuss it in our storm section. Let us carry on from there. Neil, what happened on this week's episode of Lost?
Oh, so many great things happened in this week's episode of Lost. This episode is called Trisha Tanaka is Dead, and it was directed by Eric Lenouville and written by friends of the pod, Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. It has a runtime of 44 minutes and aired February 28th, 2007. It takes place on day 76 on the island, which means we've skipped forward a couple of days, I guess, from where we sort of were last week. In flashbacks, we learn a little bit more about Hurley's relationship with his own bad dad, played by Cheech Marin, who left him alone with a candy bar as a child and rode off on a motorcycle. Very dark. We also return to the events of Hurley's post-lottery life, where local reporter Trisha Tanaka has just been killed by a meteor while touring Mr. Cluck's chicken joint. It's only a matter of time before Bad Dad shows back up looking for his retirement. One quick con later, and Hurley's off to Australia to seek the source of the numbers. Back at the beach, Hurley and Charlie are still trying to unravel the mystery of Charlie's death when Vincent comes running out of the jungle with a dead man's arm. Despite obviously forgetting about Walt, Vincent has found a van in the jungle, which is very important work for Vincent. Elsewhere, Kate and Sawyer finish their argument from the last episode, then return to camp where Sawyer immediately begins looking for his loot. Kate, on the other hand, heads out into the jungle to recruit some help for Operation Rescue Jack, which I guess if you want to, in what might be one of Lost's absolute best scenes, Hurley and Charlie make their own luck and get the van running in the most dangerous possible way. It's a triumph of hope. Vincent is there. Sawyer is happy. Jin celebrates. It's great. It all ends out in the jungle with Kate, Locke, and Saeed finding and recruiting Russo and convincing her that it is time to go get her daughter back. Fun fact about this episode. The last time we saw Jin, the character, was in Further Instructions, which for us was only a few episodes ago. But for people watching, that aired on October 18th of the previous year, and this episode aired at the end of February. So the audience had gone that long without seeing Daniel Dae Kim and his really good hair.
Gleaming
good season three
teeth.
Hair.
Gleaming.
Yeah, and his just exceptional everything. This week's calm question, if Hurley burst out of the jungle and said he found a van and wanted to try getting it started, would you volunteer? Or would you be a Paolo? Joanna?
Oh my God. My life motto is don't be a Paolo. But, unless right. unless the question is like about being handsome or tall or tan or whatever. I absolutely go with Hurley. I have no skills with a car. But like my motto on the island would 100% be hang out with Hurley all the time. So honestly, yeah. Hurley asked me to do anything. Hurley's like, I found a pile of bear poop and I think it's important we go through it. I would be like, okay, let me fashion these tarps into some gloves and I'll be right with you. Like I would do anything with Hurley. That's my answer.
Nice. I mean, I think it's clear that Nikki wanted to go, but Paolo really ruined it. Dave, are you helping with the van?
Oh, I mean, I don't like needless physical labor, but it's like day, 76? So my monkey elevator's done. So yeah, why not? I need something to do. I need to keep the brain active or I'm going to start, you know, seeing Bible verses as compass headings or something crazy like that.
Yeah. And all you want is non-denominational compass headings.
All I want is non-denominational compass headings.
I think it's telling that all of us would help Hurley, but only Jin sort of
and
inadvertently
Jin
volunteers at the beginning
understand.
Of this episode. Yeah.
So people just need to
put more respect on Hurley.
I can be as useful as Sawyer in this circumstance.
Sure.
I can sit around and drink warm beer and give Jin less sexist English advice, you know, English lessons on how to talk to women. And I would not call anyone any offensive nicknames. But I could still be fun drinking warm beer and making a running commentary. And then when it comes time, I don't know how I feel about flipping the van. That seems hard. But I would definitely push the van from behind. I could do that probably.
Yeah. Well, they got good leverage with the tree, with the.
Yeah. I would say it's the exact opposite because flipping the van is like it's a one heft, right? But like, if you're like at the front of the van, like if you're pushing from the passenger side of the van and you trip on a rock on a normal hill on an island of mystery, you go right under that van and you are dead. That would scare the crap out of me.
Yeah. That's probably how it happened for Roger.
Yeah, that's
Roger Workman. Can I add yes and your fun fact of this episode?
Mm-hmm.
Fun fact, Jack does not appear in this episode.
Yay!
Another fun fact. I was thinking about like my favorite episodes of Lost, because this is in my top five. I don't have a nice tidy order in my top five, but I have a top five. We've probably answered this before in the storm, and I just forgot what I said before, but I think it's still around the same. And almost all, I think 4 out of 5 of them barely or have 0 Jack in them. And that's not intentional. I didn't go like hunting for like Jack-free episodes. That just happens to be the flavor of Lost that I prefer. I'll talk about this more in the storm, but I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I even the first time around, I felt like I never felt like I gravitated toward Jack as a character that I liked, but like Hurley is my guy.
Yeah.
You know, and this story speaks to me on a bunch of levels, you know. It's another bad dad story. It's another Hurley's sort of struggle with not just like his weight and, but like his anxiety, which I think is the thing that's very relatable to me. And ultimately like his paranoia about winning the lottery. I feel like there isn't much variation in how I would react to winning the lottery than other than being like, oh my God, this is going to go so poorly. This is going to be cursed. So yeah, Hurley. And then this one is just, it's another episode like the golf course episode where Hurley decides that everybody needs a win, or like that the camp needs a win in order to sort of maintain sanity. And, I don't know, maybe it's the 2020, of it all, but it really resonates where it's like, sometimes you gotta just be like, we're gonna get a win here, you know, no matter how bad it is.
Pull some sort of weird win, out of the ether.
In the end, like, starting the van doesn't solve anything, you know, it helps Hurley sort of get past some of the emotional baggage he brought with him to the island. And, but it makes everybody feel good at the end. And we, you know.
Well, I really like it as like the man of science gentleman, who, you know, can be convinced to be a man of faith, but usually just by good storytelling. You make your own luck is really straight in between those two concepts. Like enough for me that, it really folds into, you know, Hurley needing to make spontaneous joy just for himself. Cause he's, you know, talking to Libby about how like things have been down, but then he's able to pivot and make that great, pitch to Charlie where he's like, you know, if you win, if like every time you don't die. And then it's also something that, through use of the song, is able to sort of tie back to him and his dad. And even though David Reyes isn't a good dad, he's not the worst dad that we've seen so far. And I like...
Stiff competition there, though.
Well, it's funny because like, I consider David Reyes, and I don't think this is a major spoiler to say this is not the last time we've seen Cheech Marin on Lost. Mm-hmm. I don't consider David Reyes... I feel like he's I already forget our D&D alignments. But to me, he's like one of those like neutral dads.
He's a true neutral dad.
Yeah. But it's interesting. It was interesting because when we were doing the live watch in the Slack, Neil immediately was like, this is a bad dad. And I was like, oh, you know what? I don't have experience with this flavor of bad dad. And Neil apparently does. And so I'm not going to argue with Neil about this flavor of bad dad. But, I think even in this episode, there, you know, cause like, I don't know that there's a correct, one correct answer to this, but I tend to believe, Cheech/ David Reyes in that last sort of speech before Hurley leaves. And, you know, you're watching it and you're like, if Hurley hadn't gone, you know, he would have been,
he would have never known about the 4 billion beings, and we all would have been worse for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess we don't know what would have happened if Hurley wouldn't have gone to Australia. But yeah, I mean, it's a bad dad move. And I think that what's really good about this, and I think what makes it work so well in the episode, is that last scene where, like, Cheech is so good. And it's just like, all right, fine, man. I kind of get it. Like, everybody would be weird if their kid won the lottery and they were estranged, you know? So yeah, I mean, I get it. I just, for me in this, I just get so wrapped up in the Hurley of it all that it's like, I'm ready to like kick dad and kind of mom in this one. Mom's got her own game going on here.
Here's the deal.
That she reveals.
Here's the deal with Hurley's mom. It's like, I feel like she's absolutely entitled to this.
Oh, sure.
Like, she can live her own life and reconcile with her husband and have sex for the first time in however many years and, like, whatever. But, like, where is the respect of the fact that, like, she's in the house that Hurley bought? You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm not saying she needs to, like, just have a little bit more respect for him, as she has every right to demand respect from him when he was living in her house as an adult. You know what I mean?
Like, and I think the thing that they do that is bad for Hurley is that they continue to treat his belief that the numbers are cursed as like a, you know, not necessarily a joke, but like a thing that's not real.
Yeah.
Which does feel like a
gaslighting,
a continued thing where it's like, it's sort of like a, where you're not recognizing someone's mental illness. You're not listening to someone when they tell you like, oh, like, this is how I feel about this. And it's like, oh, well, you don't really feel that way. You know, like they try and con him out of this feeling of like existential dread that he has around the lottery numbers. So not great parenting, but, you root so hard for Hurley that you want him to work it out. Like you want him to all figure it out.
This is the episode where in the storm, for the episode, Dave, we pointed out that Hurley's, you know, problem with, portion control with food might have sprouted from the fact that his father, also named Dave, is like, don't worry about these candy bars. I'm going to go to Las Vegas for a little bit, and disappears for most of his adult life. And so, you know, maybe there's some Dave manifesting elsewhere in Hurley as just like the bad things. So it's even, it's really smart of this episode. Not only is it written really smart, but to cast Cheech Marin, and Cheech plays it really smart. There's enough explanations for everything that David Reyes does here. He's straight up with Hurley that he's there for the money. Like Joanna mentioned, he you know, is back together with the mom, and the mom deserves to make that call for herself, and that's all fine. But it is all cast against this thing that Hurley doesn't let us forget, which is that he left and was never there. And he left in a way that really seemed like he was putting himself before his son, even though he was saying a whole bunch of things, making promises to his son that he knew he wasn't going to keep.
Let me clarify my bad dad feelings about David Reyes, which is that like, what he did when Hugo was a kid, that's straight up bad dad, right? He comes back because he hears about the money, but like, I also believe that like, he's not only there for the money. I also genuinely believe, and maybe I'm giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt, that he's there because he wants to repair some, like, the thing that he did in his youth that he is like ashamed of. Like taking Hurley to the psychic that he has paid off, like, is that a bad dad move or is a good dad move? It's a bad dad move because it's like condescending and dishonest, right? But like, to what end? And the end was to try to like alleviate Hurley's anxiety, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, through the most sort of superficial way possible rather than treating it like a systematic problem.
I'm not saying it was a good idea, but I'm just saying like, why did he want to do that? Was it to like, bilk Hurley of all his money and run off with it? It doesn't seem that way. You know, that's like, that's true bad dadding. This is like, yeah, I'm landing with neutral dad, neutral bad dad.
Yeah. Well, and I do think that like that scene at the end where Hurley is in the van and he's just sort of like sitting there having a thoughtful moment.
That
does seem like a moment where he's reflecting on the fact that like the thing his dad said to him, basically the last time they saw each other before he left for Australia, was what got him through this crisis. So like, I guess maybe at the end of this, Hurley's probably neutral on his dad, you know? And, that's probably a good place to be, especially after the guy left you for 17 years. Yeah. That's a good spot to get back to.
I mean, this episode also does a lot with a little in the sense that my feeling about David Reyes will be able to change if he does or does not stick around.
Sure.
Like the whole thing about like owning your past mistakes and whatnot is, it does, you know, require a degree of atonement And the reality is we want to see Hurley get that van running on the island. So we really just need a little bit of backstory, and David being there. But I really think it's one of our smartest dad characters in terms of how it's written and presented. In this episode, I think about Joy, like he has to be, Cheech has to be the hardest shit about this episode. And they managed to still make it something that ends up being mildly hopeful, which I think is the tone of the entire episode bends that way. And it feels great, especially after the opening of this season was basically like Alcatraz Island, no hope town. Let's have fun psychologically torturing our characters we really like. this is a great breath of fresh air.
Hurley, sticking up for himself with Sawyer.
With nicknames. Yeah.
Love it.
And I was like, when's the last time? I was like, we just saw Hurley do this, right? And it was like when Hurley tackled Sawyer and Jin was like laughing. That was in Dave, which is another Kitsis and Horowitz joint. So I'm going to look in the future for Kitsis and Horowitz. Like, just they're like, we know this is a winner. Hurley sticking up for
Hurley
himself
fights
Sawyer.
Back.
Yeah. We love to see it. So, yeah.
This is our move.
Well, and I really like the Sawyer in this episode as well. There was something off about him and Kate, and I think I may have pinged it on Kate last episode, but mostly I think because Sawyer had like that nice scene with Carl that was very good Sawyer. But here I think they rebalance it, whatever that alchemy is. I love Dart in the Foot. I love them getting atypically mad at each other and like just barely missing being able to talk to each other. I like that being visually illustrated by another, you know, coming home to the beach scene, which we love, but they also like miss their longing glances at each other. And then Sawyer decides to be sad and drink beer with the bros and try to forget about his breakup. all tracks for me in Sawyer trying to wrestle with Kate. Kate is still doing like a power grab that I think they try to make her really forceful so they could build to the climax of this episode. So I'm excited to see where Kate's going, but I'm happy to see.
Power grab is an interesting description. Why do you feel like it's a power grab?
Because she's not going to form a team. She's realized that of the experience. She's realized coming back with Sawyer that the experience that they had on the island, she's the only one that has the interpretation that she needs to go back for Jack. She feels like it's Jack's thing, and she kind of leaves without asking for anybody's help. So in terms of being asked, usually Kate's being asked to join a mission that's already in progress. If she does, like, if she has launched her mission previously, she forms a team, usually. Except, I guess, for the case, but that she was with Sawyer and discovered accidentally. It seems like she's forceful and clear and has no ulterior motivation, which I would say power grab only because it moves her directly into the A circle of people on the beach, I think. Because, like, Saeed and Locke are like, we had a compass bearing, and she's like, I know exactly where I'm going. And it's not she knows exactly where to find Jack, it's that she has a fucking plan.
Yeah, I guess I would push back against the description. I mean, maybe it's just semantics at this point, but like power grab makes it seem to me like she would want power the way that, like, I don't know, Sawyer stealing the guns is, that's a power grab. This, to me, from everything you described, just seems like she doesn't want to fuck around with anyone else. She knows what she needs to do, and she's just going to do it. And so that's not her, like, jockeying for some kind of position. That's her just, like, not, you know, no, feeling like this is personal and I need to do it sort of thing.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, it's, and especially after, I guess, for the characters, after what they've gone through, and then for the audience as well, after what we've kind of gone through watching them in Cage Town, it's good to see them come back and then split them up and take them in two completely different directions. Like with Kate, it's like, yeah, she gets a sense of purpose and she's going to go off and have this mission. And it works in this episode because she doesn't have to get all the way to her mission. We know that that's coming. We can hang with Sawyer and his sort of lack of purpose in this episode. And he gets round, you know, he gets kind of caught up in Hurley's, you know, good time show. And that's a really good place for Sawyer. And I really like that. I'm glad they sort of split them up. It felt weird in the last episode because it felt sort of like they were manufacturing things, reasons to split them up. But when they finally get back and they go their separate ways, it's like, oh, I see, you know, Kate's got to go deal with the Jack thing. Sawyer's going to relax for a little bit and, you know, hang out with the bros. And I like it. I mean, I think I agree with Joanna that, like, I don't know. Yeah. Power grab, maybe not, but she sees sort of a vacuum of leadership. Like there's really not, she's already had the conversation with John and Saeed. And beyond that, there aren't really many A teamers left who are sort of around and ready to go, you know?
Right. She's not going to do it with Sawyer.
She's not going to recruit Desmond,
right?
Because Desmond's weird now.
She could, she could grab Jin, but like, you know, whatever.
He and Sun are doing English lessons and he's got to be there for Hurley. So yeah, it's like, I kind of like how this works.
Yeah.
I like the split, you know,
and I really
it feels good.
And I like, you know, Dave really disliked the Sawyer and Kate interaction last week's episode. And I think I remember during the live watch you saying like, the conversation that Sawyer and Kate have right before they go into camp in this week's episode to you feels like the better version of what they were trying to do last week. Is that accurate, Dave?
Yes. Yeah. It's last week I felt like I knew why Kate was angry and I knew what Sawyer was doing, but it also felt like a reductive version of a conversation these two characters who now know each other would have. I feel like this week's conversation and the way that Sawyer and Kate are then treated afterwards when they get back is like, they've got each other's number at this point. And they're both sort of, you know, Sawyer's sad because he has like this weird fucking idea in his head that he doesn't deserve to like be happy. But Kate's sort of like got Sawyer's number and she knows that he's not going to give in because he's like kind of a dick. But it's much more, I think, of a conversation between peers where I feel like something about last episode, it felt like they were just talking at each other, not like with each other. Because when those two actors are like working, their chemistry, both when they're mad with each other and when they're flirting with each other, is fantastic. And so it's kind of hard to pinpoint when the alchemy isn't there, why it isn't. But for whatever reason, it's like back. I'm okay with it. I think Neil's right in that, like, they needed them to have the C story in an episode about Jack's tattoos and Juliet's trial. And because of that, like, one or two scenes just kind of had to be there that I think we did better this time. And I like the fact that nobody knows where all the darts from the swan are anymore. They could be anywhere on the island waiting to stab you in the foot.
And I love the, like, Sawyer being confused because lest we forget that they... Right? They were not there for the hatch explosion?
Correct.
So that's some news that is headed toward Kate and Sawyer, I guess. That's some more things, mysteries to figure out in this jungle. So it's a nice little reminder that like they've been away for a long time.
Doesn't Sawyer find the blueprints of the road they were building down to the hatch? In the van?
I don't know if he realizes it yet, but that's definitely what
he found. Yeah, that the swan is not there anymore. Sorry, Joanna, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, there's just so much great. I think what makes, and I don't think this is too stormy to say, I think what makes this episode really great on rewatch is how many of the seeds that are planted this episode are paid off fairly quickly. In the series, so it doesn't feel like one of those mystery drops where you're like, oh, well, we never found out, blah, you know what I mean? Or like, when we found out, it was like way later and it felt like sort of them hastily tying up a loose end. Whereas this episode, and there's confirmation of that, which we'll get into a bit more in the storm, but like, this episode feels more like, as opposed to the first chunk of the season, which feels like a rudderless, ship. Now they're planning stuff and paying it off in a really deliberate fashion for the end run of this season, which makes the end run of season 3 my favorite. And so, you know, it's just really fun to watch this and like the VW van and, you know, a lot of other Dharma stuff that is dropped here. We will find out some answers soon, which is really fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. You can really feel in this episode, like I feel like with the last week's episode, we could feel their exhaustion, you know, like we could feel how tired they were at the end of that run. And when you flip over to this episode, you can really feel the energy and the passion and the confidence of the writer's room comeback. And, you know, I guess that's regardless of how bad that last one went, you know, they really did come back from their break and were like, we're about to kick off and run through sort of the best of our show. And this is the best. I think this is definitely in my top five. This might be because it's Hurley, and I reserve the right to say to change this in future Hurley episodes.
Sure.
But this might be number one for me.
It's certainly,
because it's just,
it's in competition for number one.
Before we were watching this, before we started recording, I was finishing up watching it and just like burst into tears when that music comes back on, man. That does not happen to me a lot, and that's great. So
I remember when Kitsis and Horowitz were on for Dave, they said something about how they liked to think of the flashback stories as like little New Yorker stories, like little self-contained stories. I'm not sure how well the Cheech of it all works as a little self-contained New Yorker story, but the van is 1,000% a great little short story. Like you could read that in like a sudden fiction class or something like that. And just like that idea of like, you need some relationship context for this, but also just the pure joy of like, I really want to do this improbable thing. And then improbably I do it. And it's a simple act of fixing a car on an island where a car is really useless.
Absolutely useless. I mean, I also love, and this is such a smaller part of it, but I kind of love the way they use Charlie in this, in this episode.
It. Yeah.
Because not only Charlie's dealing with a lot, you know, and we can see that in the scene with Desmond where it's just like, you can't even imagine this craziness of knowing that you're going to die, or like somebody else knowing that you're going to die and you not knowing. And so Hurley is sort of the balm for Charlie in this moment. And he sees that and he goes, you know, we got to make this happen. We need to get you beyond this. Otherwise it's going to just eat you alive. And, you know, that feels like just some of the best friendship stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And then you get the bonus of Sawyer and Jin being, Sawyer, Jin, and Vincent being there is just like the best boy band.
The scene when they just like, I mean, first of all, like Jin flinging, Daniel Day Kim flinging his arms in the air and like going, Hurley is like just serotonin, like straight shot to your brain. But like, them running and like climbing in, and the dog's there too. And it's just like beers and bros and a pup in a car with some tunes. Yeah. Like just this.
I mean,
like,
Sawyer
weird slice of
almost got shot like 3 days ago in the head.
And you're so right. Whichever one of you did this, I think Neil, like to compare this to the golf course episode. Cause it is, it's just like, let's just find some normalcy because we really need it, man. You know, so, I like how one of our listeners while we were doing the live watch, because of course this started as a Game of Thrones podcast, you know, brought up that like Hurley quote where it's, what do you like, we say whatever man, what does he say? What's his quote? He says, let's get this car started. Let's look death in the face and say whatever man. And like someone in our Slack was like, what do we say to the god of death? Whatever man.
Whatever, man.
Such a Hurley move. Yeah, Hurley slapping Charlie, saying essentially, like, snap out of it, come do this fun thing with me. And then Dominic Monaghan being, like, his most merry, as in The Hobbit merry, in his, like, joy of joining him, like, does a lot to make me team Charlie.
Sure.
When I've been struggling with Charlie for a very long time.
It's even fine at the end where he's like, back and he's sort of like happily recounting his story to Claire, and they're having like a nice moment. It's like, oh, they're not, he's not stealing the baby.
All it takes is 20 days and you just forget that somebody tried to steal their baby.
Listen, island time works differently.
Yeah.
That was day 56. I was looking that up where you guys were talking about Charlie. Yeah. I was like, how long was it since he tried to steal the baby? 20 days to the dot.
Really quickly before we roll into the corners, which I'm happy to do in 1 second, Dave, I want to ask you, Dave, a question. Yes. And I asked Alan Sepinwall the same question. Does the title of this episode make you, remind you of like a Darren Morgan X-Files episode?
Like Clive Barker, Bruckman's Final Repose?
Yeah.
Or, okay, yes. I was going to say, or Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
He did both of those. So those are Darren Morgan episodes. I don't know. They just sound like Darren Morgan titles to me. Right?
Oh, yeah. Darren Morgan, who just loves putting those names in the titles that then don't... You can't just call it like the van one, can you, buddy?
No, you got to call it Clyde Bruckman or Jose Chung.
I do think it's funny that apparently the meteor hitting Mr. Klux is the most expensive shot, single shot loss had done up until this point.
Yeah.
And we did not mention it in the normal recap of the show. That's how good this episode is around the corners.
Yeah. And it's not bad either.
No.
Like, it's a pretty good sequence.
Yeah.
You know, 2007 polygon wise.
Yeah. Now you could probably do it on your iPhone 11, but then.
Right. Like, kids on TikTok are making that meteor shower look good now.
Back in the day. All right, it's time for corners. Neil, kick us off with some Giacchino corner.
Well, as you know, the episode opens and sort of closes with Shambhala by Three Dog Night. Returns toward the end with an orchestral variation just called Shambhala, also same name, from Mr. Giacchino. There's a couple other cues that appear here. The Lone Hugo, which I believe is somewhere in the middle of the episode, which includes a couple of different Hurley themes, and Fetch Your Arm, which is another Hugo theme. And then this one, this is the one I really want to talk about. Ain't Talking About Nothing is a track from this episode, and it's a variation on Kate and Sawyer's theme. Kate and Sawyer's theme being the scene from The Cage, when they were having a moment. So they built on that in this episode, which honestly I didn't notice too much, but because you get really caught up in Shambhala. Like,
so good.
It's, I can't hear that song without thinking of this episode. So good luck getting me to think of other music that played during this episode.
Okay, can I do two Giacchino things really quickly? Well,
sure.
Number one, one of our lovely listeners, I think it was Phil, would be my guess, kept mentioning that this is like only the fourth most famous Three Dog Night song, and was like maybe insinuating that there should be a different Three Dog Night song in there. So like, is there a different Three Dog Night song that you would put in there?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know if I know any other
Joy to the World is probably the most famous one, right? Mama Told Me Not to Come. That's a really famous one. An old fashioned love song. Eli's Coming.
I mean, it's just like this song has that perfect moment, which is what comes on when they finally get the band started.
Yeah.
But like the howl, where they come in howling, where it's just, I don't know. I don't think you could find a better. And we just finished watching Breaking Bad in the Slack, which is notoriously good needle drops.
Yeah.
But there are few better TV needle drops than like this one right here. You know, I guess not technically a needle drop, but you know, the use of like diegetic music. This is incredible. It's one of my favorites of all time.
I can't pick a better Three Dog Night song, but I do like one better than this.
Which one do you like better?
Want the song one? I would not put it in this scene because it would make no sense. But if Phil was just talking about there are other Three Dog Night songs that are more popular than this, then yes, that jumps to my mind. But better for this scene, can't think of one.
And then I just want to say that I was watching Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol over the weekend with a pal of mine for a good mood boost. One of my favorite action movies of all time. Perfect film, I think. Obviously, music by Michael Giacchino, and a little nice little cameo from Josh Holloway in that show, that movie. Can I read to you really quickly, just really quickly, some track names from the Ghost Protocol soundtrack?
Yes, please.
We start with "Give Her My Budapest," like "Give Her My Best," but Budapest, right? "In Russia, Phone Dials You." That's one.
All right, because this is the one where they go to the Kremlin.
Yeah, yeah. Which brings us to our next track, "Kremlin with Anticipation," followed by "From Russia with Shove." And then "A Man, a Plan, a Code, Dubai" is one. And then Lea Seydoux plays a character whose last name is Moreau. So it's Moreau Trouble Than She's Worth. They go to India, so Mumbai is the word comes up. And then the last one is "Putting the Miss in Mission," which could either mean the fact that the nuke barely misses hitting San Francisco, or Tom Cruise misses Michelle Monaghan, or Michelle Monaghan is the titular miss in Mission Impossible. I don't know. There's like layers there.
Yeah, I mean, she is his wife, I guess.
From Giacchino. Yeah, I guess she's a missus. She'd be putting the missus in Mission, so it doesn't work. Anyway, it was funny. We were watching it, and I was like, oh, this is that good Giacchino shit. Then I was like, oh, I'm going to look, because my friend that I was watching with, was not aware of Giacchino's proclivity for puns. So anyway.
His pun talents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a Ghost Protocol corner. There you go.
Our juggle mystery moment this week goes to the mysterious body Roger Workman.
Roger Workman.
His job and his last name, for all we know.
Definitely when your work-life balance is not
yep.
that right. whack.
When you're stuck on a jungle of mystery, driving around in a van with some beer and some recycling.
Roger Workman.
Just listen to Three Dog Night. Surely that guy's life was not depressing at all. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award also goes to Roger, but not all of Roger, just his head, which gets separated from the rest of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I guess his arm gets separated from the rest of him, but Roger's not keeping it together too well. The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes to "We're Gonna Break the Curse" by absent father David Reyes. Not everybody is being obviously liars in this episode. His Ben's not in it, so that's a light one, but let's give him a trophy anyway. Joanna, how did we do on last week's Jungle of Kistery?
Well, there was a lot of Jack, you may recall, in last week's episode, Stranger in a Strange Land. So Jack is in three of these choices here. At the bottom, coming dead last, Carlin Sawyer. No one was feeling that, I guess perhaps because Carl is supposed to be a literal teen, but that only got 17% of the vote. So, right? Carl's a teenager?
I don't know. So, he's like early 20s. I always read him and Alex as
Alex
20.
Is supposed to be like 16. So let's hope that Carl is.
All right. Carl better be younger than that.
all right. Jack and Kites, 23% of the vote. Jack and the Sand, 22% of the vote. But the winner, is a suggestion from one Mr. Neil Miller, which is Jack and Getting the Fuck Out of Her Space. 36% of the vote. So.
Respecting personal space for the win.
All right. And this week we've got a wide range of options here. Our listener Eastern Violet suggests Hurley's Hand and Charlie's Face. A nice snap out of it moment for Hurley and Charlie. Our listener Beth suggests Vincent and Roger's Arm. Adam recommends The Kiss of Death between the meteor and Trisha Tanaka.
Sorry, Trisha Tanaka.
And Karen suggests Sawyer and the Warm Jungle Beer. So,
especially at the end there, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody more sensually drink a can of warm beer than Josh Holloway at the end of this. Well, it's like, but he also really loves that beer.
I mean, he loves that beer because Kate's gone, and he's like, and Jin's like, hey, son, and Charlie's like, hey, Claire, and Hurley's like, hey, the van, and Sawyer's like, hey, me by myself.
But then he's like, beer.
Someone we forgot to mention really quickly is one Mr. Randy Nations, who this is his third appearance. Lost. We should mention that. He mysteriously, his change of careers is very, I need a timeline for Randy Nations, if I'm being honest with you.
Right.
Well,
this
I think
Randy Nations hair watch would have been a thing, I think was what we decided in the live watch.
Yeah, at some point he's like, listen, this box factory's boring. Can I go back to managing a chicken restaurant?
Right. So he's like Hurley's manager, then he leaves, and then he's John's manager, and then Locke's manager, and then at some point goes back to work with Hurley, but also Hurley buys the box company. That's something we already know as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, Hurley became a millionaire.
Oh, and then it burns down, right?
Like, did Hurley become a millionaire and buy his shitty old manager's box, like, company? So that I could be like, Randy, I own you. Now you have to come back and work
for me
and do demeaning chicken labor. I don't know.
I can't think of another reason that Hurley would buy a box company.
It's the Randy Nations connection. Or did he, like, hire Randy back, and Randy's like, Hurley, I got a great idea for an investment for you, bro. Now that we're buds again, I guess.
You know what, buddy? I really only did one good thing in my whole life now that you saved me from that box company, and that was manage that chicken shack. Maybe we should go back to that now.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not entirely sure why Randy gets brought back by Hurley, because he was not a good boss.
No. Yeah, I don't know if, like, Hurley took some pleasure in, like, having Randy as a subordinate, but they also seem, like, fairly chummy at this point. Anyway, mm-hmm. If someone wants to write me a little Randy Nations timeline and email us, host at stormpodcast.com, I'd appreciate it.
Speaking of weird, convoluted timelines, I came up with the Where's Libby this week. Libby, as you might recall, ended her run on Lost too soon, but does have a penchant for popping up in other people's flashbacks. So, where was Libby this week? Okay, so we all know that Libby, her husband was also Dave. And we also know that Libby says she was married 3 times. So, what if Libby met David Reyes in Las Vegas at some point, and realizing all Daves are one Dave, she marries him in a brief wedding and then has it annulled? So, in between David Reyes leaving Hurley and coming back, at some point, he was briefly married to Libby. Huh?
Okay. Huh? I mean, but also, Libby's literally in this episode.
I mean, yeah, she's in her grave.
I mean, I'm all for an all Daves are one Dave theory. It's my favorite theory I've lost. But also, Libby is technically in this episode.
Are you saying that all of Libby's 3 husbands were named Dave? Is that what you're getting to here?
Sure.
I don't know, but now it's.
I feel like that's
like
what we're working
possible.
Towards.
Do we know that Libby was married 3 times?
Yes.
Wow, I forgot that.
She says it twice, once to Hurley and I think once to Anna Lucia.
I believe it.
The only thing I don't like about this is that this now implies that Hurley then dated someone, sort of dated someone who was his stepmom for like 10 minutes.
Oh, no.
And he's Eskimo Brothers with his dad. It makes me like his dad less. And you guys had really done a lot of work earlier in the episode convincing me that he wasn't so bad.
Dave Whitten made up a fact.
We are out on David Reyes again.
poor person Dave made up.
All right. I have another adjacent corner.
Yeah.
I was watching an episode of Alias earlier today because I am slow rolling my way through Alias season 1. And this is the first episode where Terry O'Quinn pops up. I think it's episode 17. And then there's a flashback to this earlier episode where, Sydney Bristow, played, by the great Jennifer Garner, falls down a long, like, hole in the ground into, something below. And my friend who I was watching it with was like, this episode has both The Hatch and Locke in it. And I was like, oh. Anyway, apparently that's the, I mean, that's the role, his guest star on Alias. He did it for 3 seasons, I think, is what got him the role on Lost. So, you know, if you're a Lost completist, you should probably watch some Alias.
Nice.
And our final corner for the interview is the official podcast check-in. Usually we check in with Damon and Carlton, who are running an official podcast. But for this stretch of episodes, I think they're gone until The Man from Tallahassee. So this week is just an interview with Josh Holloway, Jorge Garcia, and Daniel Day Kim. Jorge talks about training the dog with a toy that looked like a human arm for a couple of weeks. Josh Holloway talks about sneaking in a real beer into his scenes with Daniel Day Kim. And you know, Daniel Day Kim is like, I just like hanging out with these guys. So that's the official podcast check-in. Let's get to Joanna's talk with Alan Sepinwall right now.
Alan Sepinwall, chief TV critic at Rolling Stone. Is that your honorific, my friend?
I believe it is, yes. Thank you.
thank you so much for joining us here. You specifically requested this episode, which is no surprise because it's one of the most beloved popular episodes of Lost. What, in your mind, makes Trisha Tanaka's Dead so great?
It's a fun episode. It's like Hurley says at one point when he's trying to explain to everybody why they need to actually go to the effort to repair a car in the middle of a deserted island. And he says, we could all use some fun. And this came, you know, around the time that season 3 was starting to make the turn away from the polar bear cages and all the other unfortunate stuff that had been happening early that season. And what I like about it is it's the kind of episode that I don't think would be made now on almost any show, because it's the product of Lost being a traditional broadcast network drama that did 22 or more episodes a year for a number of years. And so there's sort of this dirty word sometimes where people will talk about filler episodes where it's like, oh, nothing really important happened here. And nothing really important happens here. There's some subplot stuff moving along in the background, but the actual story about Hurley wanting to repair this VW bus and the 4 guys hanging out in the jungle together and having a good time, and the flashback to Hurley's bad luck and his history with his dad and all of that is really so satisfying in such a self-contained manner that, you know, it doesn't need major arc things. It's just a really good and entertaining episode of television.
Yeah, and I think were it not for the, you know, small percentage of Kate stuff that's in this episode, I think people might be frustrated at a let's press pause and have some fun when Jack is still, you know, kidnapped. Why aren't they more worried about Jack, et cetera? But you've got Kate's on that beat and everyone else can do this other thing instead, you know?
Yes, exactly. Kate died for our sins. So that Sawyer can drink like really old and probably skunky beers in the middle of the jungle.
So the bros could have some fun in the jungle.
isn't that always the way?
This is also, well, I did want to get your thoughts. You talked to me a little bit about it when we chatted about the finale anniversary, but I don't think it made it into the final supercut of that episode. Your feelings on Jack, and this is a Jack-free episode. And for many people, that's a good thing. You know, our first time watchers who are not enjoying Jack here. What are your feelings on Jack that you can articulate here in the middle of season 3?
Okay, so this was a really bad time to be someone watching Jack Shepard, whether you liked him or not initially. And I did like Jack at the beginning of the series. And then they sort of took him down a bad road. And unfortunately, it feels like Damon and Carlton and the rest of the writers really decided that, like, Jack was going to be their tool to slow stuff down. Anytime, like, there was a chance of people sharing information, finding out things, asking questions, Jack would always come in and throw some kind of temper tantrum. Or I forget what it is when Ben has him prisoner a couple episodes before this, and he says, all right, you can ask me any one thing. And he asks, you know what it is, but he asks the dumbest goddamn,
oh,
most useless question.
If Sarah's happy, is that the question?
Yes! Well, like, what value is this to you right now, Dr. Jack Shepard, while you're trapped on this island by the, you don't know anything, and this is what you ask. Come on!
My favorite, though, is that Juliet has an answer for him where she's like, yes, she is. And I'm like, is that in your file? Sarah's happiness is in your file? Okay.
But no, so he had just become this incredibly obstinate head in the sand character. Mm-hmm. And I understand, like, to a degree, like, this was a point when they didn't know how long the show was going to go, so they weren't sure at what rate they could dole out answers and explanations and advance the plot. And so someone, unfortunately, has to pay the bill and be the one to keep things from moving forward. But it's almost always Jack at this period of the show. So it did not even occur to me until you mentioned it that he's not in this. And that's not the only reason it's a really fun episode, but it certainly does not hurt that the show's biggest buzzkill is completely absent.
Well, you know, Nikki and Paolo show up to kill some buzz, you know.
Oh, Nikki. Right. That's We're still a few episodes away from people really, truly, finally, hopefully appreciating Nikki and Paolo. But yeah, they can be problematic.
What is going on here in season three? You mentioned, like, they haven't, I think, fully negotiated their ending spot yet. They're transitioning. So, like, here's what I'll say. First season of Lost is, like, one of the greatest seasons of television ever. The idea of the flashback revealing slowly to us who these online characters are is brilliant. What we're discovering here in season three during this rewatch is that the concept is really running on empty in terms of, like, you know, you mentioned the bear cage section at the beginning of the season. Rewatching those episodes, I don't hate the on-island stuff. It's really the, like, you know, you can make fish biscuit jokes and bear cage jokes and stuff like that, but, like, the on-island stuff isn't that bad. It's the flashback stuff that's really bad because they're, like, all out of material for their main characters. So, you know, what is Lost transitioning into that it doesn't, like, burn out entirely here in its third season?
Well, I mean, this is something you and I talked about when I came on in season one to talk about the later Kate episode, which is even by the end of that season, there were some characters who they were starting to run out of backstory material about. And it becomes a lot hit or miss around this portion of the show. Like, the Hurley story with his dad is not revealing that much that's new other than him being yet another Lost character with daddy issues. But it's entertaining because Hurley is an entertaining character, but more to the point, like, the degree to which the bad luck is manifesting itself, particularly with the moment that gives the episode its title, is just so crazy that it's fun in and of itself. And then it ties in very well to the story that's happening on the island. But there's a lot of characters where it's just like, I didn't need to keep going home with some of these people. And, you know, they had just done the How Jack Got His Tattoos episode, which was the nadir of the show. And you know, I think when I interviewed Carlton for The Revolution Was Televised, my book, he said, like, I don't know that we were, like, consciously trying to make a bad episode there, but maybe somewhere back in the, like, in the recesses of our minds, this was our way of proving to ABC that something needed to change.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, Damon has said something similar where it's just sort of like, and then we did Stranger to Strangeland and then they had to listen to us and give us an end date, you know, sort of thing. Yeah. It's comforting to be able to tell people when they are in the doldrums of early season three, you're like, yeah, but you're coming up to one of the greatest episodes of television ever, which is Trisha Tanaka is dead. So, you know, hang in there.
Yeah. And also, without spoiling anything, I will say, if you're really, really annoyed with Jack right now, hang in there as well, because Jack was my least favorite character on television around this period. And by the end of the show, I really like Jack again. So yeah. I think that if you're frustrated with him now, you'll be very satisfied where things end up.
You'll at least be more satisfied than you are now, for sure. Do you feel like, I didn't dig into this at all, but do you feel like this title is at all a reference to the great Darren Morgan episodes of The X-Files?
That had not occurred to me, but I could certainly see, you know, like Jose Chung's From Outer Space and Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. There's a bit of that. What it always makes me think of, for whatever reason, is the very early Saturday Night Live running gag about, you know, Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead. But I don't know what the actual source that Kitsis and Horovitz used to come up with it, but it is certainly a memorable title. There's a lot of episodes of the show that I love that I could not for the life of me tell you what they were called.
Right.
This one I will never forget.
So when we're in this episode, this is also a section of the show where I think they start to really improve on the character of Charlie, who's a character that we've been having some issues with. He's got this thing hanging over him where Desmond has said, you know, you're going to die, brother, sort of thing. And, you know, there are some bad Charlie plots in the first two seasons of the show. There's like dark Charlie. There's like stealing Claire's baby Charlie. There's kidnapping son Charlie. There's all this stuff. But now he's back in sort of like impish Lord of the Rings Mary mode, with a quick like snap out of it from Hurley. You know, what's your sense of how this episode or this season turns around on Charlie?
Well, it's a complicated thing that the show has to deal with because there, you know, we want it to, you can't do every episode like this. You can't probably do very many episodes like this where it's just everybody kind of hanging out and having a good time and listening to Three Dog Night. and so as a result, you have to sometimes have characters, you know, be bad things, do things that seem like unforgivable just because you got to generate story out of it and you have to generate conflict. And, you know, a lot of that, as you mentioned, fell on Charlie early on. And we're here at a point where I think they started to recognize, and you'll see this happen at different points with different characters, where they get very dark for a while. And then there's a moment where the writers are like, oh, wait a minute. What is the thing that we originally liked about them? And they'll go back to that. Right. And in this particular moment, you're getting that turn with Charlie. And it's a very nice thing to see.
Yeah. And Dominic Monaghan is so good in this episode. And like the other thing that shines through, I think, for me in this episode, you know, particularly with the four guys who get to work on the car together, is like what shines through is how much these actors seem to like each other. Like, especially in the montage at the end where they're just like, you know, fucking around with the car and having fun and smiling. As you say, Three Dog Night plays on the 8-track. the smiles just seem so genuinely we're having the time of our lives in Hawaii. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The look on Holloway's face when Sawyer climbs into the van is just, it's a thing of beauty. And he's always a super like charming and charismatic guy. He's one of my favorites on the show, but this in particular, like this is sort of peak Sawyer right there.
Yeah, there's in that same montage, there's an external shot of the bus and you can see Daniel Day Kim's like 1,000-watt smile from like way far away. All of his teeth are gleaming. And yep. Like everyone's just having a great time here. So, yeah.
And the thing is not to belabor this point too much, but I think one of the reasons why one of the things that I think we've lost, pardon the pun, one of the things that's gone away from the era in which this particular great television show was made that wouldn't happen now is now you have shows they're doing 13 episodes, 10, maybe only 8 in a season. So everything's got to be story, 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 story. And so there's not only time for goofy interludes like this, but there's not always necessarily time for character building like this. Mm. Like a lot of the really good stuff that happens here is, like you say, Charlie being pulled out of his funk or everybody trying to teach Jin English. There's a lot of fun there. And seeing the characters, how much they like each other and how much they get along, that then becomes super valuable when the plot kicks back in later in this season and in other seasons, because it builds up this really important foundation. And that's a trick that I think a lot of modern serialized dramas just either have forgotten how to do or simply can't do given the time allotted to them.
Is there any modern serialized drama that is pulling that off well right now?
I'm trying to think. It's been a little while. I mean, you watch as much TV as I do, Joanna. Can you think of one?
I was trying to think of, you know, like, well, I was trying to think if Damon did anything in Watchmen. I mean, certainly I think there was some room for it in Leftovers, but basically this episode is the kind of episode where you're like, oh, the blank episode. And the way you can describe it, you can just pull it out of what's going on. You know, this is stuff you've already been saying, but like just pull it out of what's going on and enjoy it. You know what I mean? Or not, or it becomes notorious and you don't enjoy it, but it's still the blank episode pulled out of the larger fabric. And I'm trying to think, you know, I mean,
The Crown weirdly does this because they have sort of a royal crisis of the week model, but otherwise has almost nothing in common with a show like this.
Yeah, and even like, you know, Succession, you're still always like, I know you're not a huge fan of that show, but you're still always like building momentum towards something. Yeah, I don't think there is this anymore in television, which is
a bummer because yeah. I like this.
Yeah, exactly. What you know, even if it doesn't have episodes like this, which show the as people reflect on the show, as people join us and talk about the show, which has been really fun, and thank you for coming on again. What becomes clear and clear and clear and clear is that it's the characters of Lost and not the events of Lost that make Lost so special.
Yes.
And that all these other shows have tried to ape Lost premise wise, but not nailing the character stuff. So I'm curious if you have thoughts about like what other shows do an equally good job or at least come close in terms of giving us those characters that we like love and want to spend time with. I have my thoughts on this, but I'm curious what yours are.
I mean, I think it's a lot of that in terms of characters you love and characters you go deep. That's really happening a lot more weirdly in the half hour space than it is in the hours. Cause I think the hour long shows right now, there's a number of excellent ones, but most of them are so plot driven. And I think the streamers have played a big influence on this because either they have research showing or whatever that like people just want to know what happens next. And you have to give them something that's going to make them click through to the next episode and keep going. And so that's what they're valuing ahead of character, ahead of atmosphere, ahead of a lot of other things. Whereas you can have these shows like, you know, Rami is in my head cause it premiered today and I just wrote about it. You know, like a Fleabag, even like something really almost plot free, like Betty on HBO, where it's just sort of like you're in the world. And it feels like a lot of the things that Lost was great at all at once have been broken down into component parts. And you have one show doing this aspect and one show doing that. But there's not a lot that are doing the whole package. I mean, some of Damon's other shows that we've talked about are come about as close as you can.
Yeah, I almost feel like if you mashed, I mean, I've been thinking about this as like deconstructing what the creators brought to the show and seeing it through their other projects, you know, like what Carlton did before and after Lost, what Damon did after Lost, what Adam and Eddie did after Lost. And you sort of like, you can mix it all together and you get Lost, you know?
Yes.
But, like, cause Carlton is more, like, you know, slightly old guard, more TV conventions. And that's definitely something that Lost dealt in. And then, like, Damon has been more interested in exploring weirder, more experimental television. And both of those
are great. And I think that's kind of, there's kind of a Lennon and McCartney aspect to it, which is, like, Carlton's formalism allows Damon to do weird shit. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So I would say, in those half hour comedies, like the Schurverse, all the Michael Schur shows.
Yes.
Those are like the, you know, like the Parks and Rec crew or the Brooklyn Nine-Nine crew or the Good Place or whatever. Like these are, not to take credit away from Dan Gore, but like these are all like characters, friends, coworkers who I just want to spend time with. I want to watch them try to get a VW van working. You know what I mean? Like that would be the dream. So.
Yeah. Like if you can make the audience care about your world and the people on it enough to do an episode where they're trying to repair a VW bus to go nowhere, to literally drive in circles because it's an island and there's no destination. You've accomplished something. You're doing your job right.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing is the genius of the character of Hurley, who, you know, our first-time watchers loved from the beginning, is that he's a character where if you as a character like him or help him in some way, we like you that much better. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, like, Jin is a character I like, but he, you know, occasionally they have to sort of push him back into his more authoritarian role because in order to like stir up some conflict with him and Son or something like that. But when he throws his arms up in the air, it's just like, Harley, you're like, I love Jin for that. Or Sawyer, you know, like being an asshole, flinging fat jokes around, that is all reprehensible. But then like when Hurley calls him redneck man and he's like, fair enough, you're just like, yay, Sawyer. You know what I mean? It's just,
Or just the look on his face when Hurley hugs him because, you know, Sawyer knows he's alive. He knows he's made it back. Sawyer's just been in his own head for a while. And all of a sudden, you know, his big friend comes up and wraps his arms around him. And Sawyer realizes, oh, right, people who care about me were really worried here.
Right. Especially, like, because he's in hardcore self-pitying stuff with Kate mode elsewhere yeah. on the island. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, boy.
And then the episode ends with a really, like, it's actually not Lost style to so hardcore set up the next episode unless you're doing a two-parter. So, like, what do you make of the ending of this episode where we get a little Rousseau moment that feels like a big cliffhanger push towards something?
I feel like that is the compromise they had to make in order to get away with the rest of this episode. Mm-hmm. Because it's so non-plotty and so goofy and laid back and just a vibe kind of episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no big dramatic type ending you can come out of this and, you know, hit the final Giacchino note and play the title card again. So you've got to basically go into to be continued mode with Rousseau. And I have to say, like, I've not been watching this along with you guys. I just watched the episodes that you and I are talking about on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And so watching this one, I was like, oh, right, right. I'm remembering this. I'm like, oh, Rousseau was somebody on the show. I liked Rousseau. What happened to Rousseau? And so, like, there's definitely certain things, especially in that end sequence and a lot of what Kate was up to, that did have me at least thinking about doing a rewatch at some point, or at minimum, like, Googling stuff to find out who lived and who died and all of that.
All right. Well, Alan, thank you so much for chatting with me. If folks want to hear more from you, read your books, and check out your new podcast projects, where can they find you?
All right. So I write at Rolling Stone. You can find me at rollingstone.com. I'm on Twitter at Seppenwall. I'm on Facebook at Alan Seppenwall and Instagram at Seppenwall. I've written a number of books. The most pertinent one, if you're a Lost fan, is one called The Revolution Was Televised, where I tell the story of a dozen different shows that are all played a different role in the creation of peak TV, basically. And the Lost chapter is the favorite one of the ones I got to write for that, because Damon and Carlton and everybody else were really candid about all the ways in which the show got made and almost went awry and then didn't and sometimes did. I've also written books about The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and Matt Zeller Seitz and I also wrote a book called TV the Book, where we ranked 100 greatest shows of all time, and Lost is featured prominently in that one as well.
Excellent. And do you want to talk about your new podcast project?
It is still top secret. It is okay. Coming eventually, but I cannot, other than saying that I do have a new podcast coming later this year, that's, I will be electroshocked if I say anything more.
All right. Well, I will say without giving any secrets away that I have, I know the premise. It's really cool and exciting, and I'm really excited to hear it. So, and I think all of the folks listening to this podcast would really enjoy that podcast specifically. So keep your eye on all of Alan's socials for more information there. And we will coerce him to come back and talk about more episodes of Lost as we can do our rewatch. So thank you, Alan Seppenwall.
Sounds great. My pleasure.
So now is the time on the podcast where we like to give our thanks to our Small Council Patreon subscribers. Those are folks at the $10 level or above. They get some extra bonus content from us. So we would like to thank them. Let us start with Raimi Quiton, I think. Jeff Cooper, Steven or maybe Stefan Fusco, Angela Flunker, Christopher Holmquist, Alicia Gressla, Elliot Goldbaum, hi Elliot, Dharma Jess, Darth Fishius, Logan Wagner or Wagner, Kevin Mullaney, Carol Blaine, Monica Rickman, Christopher Woodside, Jeremy Jerkins, Natalie Smith, Ruby Durham, Tanya Shrum, Dennis Ramirez, and Rebels Podcast. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks, Alyssa Scott, Kuang Yu Liu, Liz Major, Brian Morawski, Randy Blash, Brittany Whimsy Riot, Sam Cohen, Kate Whitney, Amber Vickers, Shosav Odale, Patricia Dulane, Tim Wiseman, Carrie King, Lauren Bree, Christopher Bates, Steph Deal, Aubrey Ayer, Elise Abschutz, Josh Brown, and Victoria Stout. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following humans: Kathy Shaberg, Lindsay Romaine, Grace Brown, A. Will, Ellen Rabin, Katie Truchon, Liz Roller, Rosie O, Billy Bosky, James Cooper, John Lillystrom, Callum Guy, Kitsuna Lane. Yeah, I think I probably mess that one up every time. Samantha O'Leary, K. Kevin Costello, Patrick Kelly, Patrick McCracken, Angela Travis, C.A. Sachs, and Kurt Klein. Thank you all so very much.
True show.
And we are back for The Storm this week. What are we starting off with? I was going to the notes always say Locke antagonist check in, but this one, he's literally like, hey, can I help you out in the forest? So
when it doesn't suit your narrative, then it's no longer important to check in.
Kate, he opposes Kate's forceful power grab when she attempts to steal the crown.
All right. I'm going to help you out here. We got a tweet from a listener, Blake. Who is a little behind. He's back in season 3, episode 3. And he says, Locke is so not Jesus. That's Jacob, right? Died and came back. Locke is like doubting Thomas. Plus, I think the snake in Gethsemane is Melad in Passion. Oh! Have you guys seen Passion of the Christ? You two?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh! I've never seen it. And so... like, I remember we got a correction at the time because you guys said there was a snake in Gethsemane, and like a bunch of our listeners were like, they were wrong. But I was like, why were they so sure, but so wrong? And I,
because of that stupid Mel Gibson movie.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah, of course.
Mel Gibson, fucking Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson antagonist check in. Still an antagonist.
Still the antagonist.
That would be a lot easier. Yeah. We could make a button that just plays that sound every time. Mel Gibson, still the antagonist. Guess who got too old for this shit? Mel Gibson.
Not Danny Glover.
Not the one
still
you thought.
Sharp.
Yeah, not
still
the
sharp.
One you thought. Neil, you said you were, when we were talking about things in this week that came back and I mentioned last week, you said something in last week ended up being important. I forgot what that was.
Oh, I'm sure there's something.
Oh, okay.
We were just assuming that there was something. Because you said that, and I was like, my brain went, no, there isn't, but I didn't want to smack down the train of thought.
Doesn't Juliet getting kicked out of the clan become a thing, right? Because now Juliet's on Team Outside? Or she's about to be on Team Outside?
Maybe, but like, we don't return to the brand, so it'd be interesting to see if we couldn't just infer that.
Argument. I think Cindy and the kids... is the thing, and you were like, no, we already argued about it, so let's...
No, I mean, Cindy and the kids is a thing that comes back. It was a whole thing.
The answer is Cindy and the kids.
And Carl, I don't know.
And Carl and Alex, I mean, they use the Alex revelation, like, right here, right? Because wasn't that part of it, too? That's when Kate figures out... Well, she's sort of been figuring it out over the last couple episodes, but...
I like the revelation. I love the way that it unfurls in this episode. I guess I could have said this in the calm, but like, we don't know that Kate has put those pieces together.
Right.
You know,
yeah. Yes.
Kate doesn't ask Alex, do you think maybe your mom is a cuckoo French lady who lives in the woods? She doesn't say anything. So we have no idea that Kate's, like, the little wheels in Kate's head has been turning until she, like, rolls up to Rousseau with this information.
She's been looking deep into Alex's eyes and being like, I know you.
Well, I think really good casting.
This is also one of the things I remember from the first time around, people being able to figure out that Rousseau and Alex, I mean, it's not like the show's not being super coy about it. So it's really fun to see a character like work out the same math that you're working out, you know, and then come out with it. It's great. It's great stuff.
But this episode, we do have Roger Linus,
gassed to death. Real bad dad of this episode is hiding in plain sight.
Man, Lost, they really know how to just give you, like, bad dad sandwiches everywhere.
The real bad dad was the severed heads we met along the way.
Yeah, we'll get to Roger. And remind me again what the VW van payoff is, because Roger, right, is Ben's father. We meet him later.
Yeah, so
but I don't remember what happens with the van later.
Well, here's a fun fact that I learned about the production of this episode is that Kitsis and Horowitz pitched the idea of a Dharma van that they find in the jungle that they use to save the day in the finale. So, like, Hurley drives the van onto the beach in the finale to, like, save
oh, that's right.
I think it's Bernard and Saeed and Sawyer? No. Anyway, some favorites. Hurley just basically like straight up murders the people with a van, which is, you love to see it. But they pitch, like, they're like, let's drop a seed of a van here that is gonna wind up saving the day in the finale. And that's that, ooh, planning ahead that you love to see. Also, mm-hmm. Roger Linus, we find out that story in episode, I think it's 20, Man Behind the Curtain. So, like, that's not that far from here. So, like, you mm-hmm. know, this stuff is just, like, gonna come back around real quick. Someone was like, why is there so much beer in that van? Like, we'll find out. Roger has a drinking
which
problem.
Which you'll learn more Roger. About that, Roger.
So, you know, and like,
which you'll learn why Ben's so fucked up.
Yeah. And like,
Roger, who maybe cursed the entire island by just raising a bad son.
And then also, like, and it feels so much more satisfying because Roger doesn't just show up in that Ben flashback. He's like a big part of the, like, Dharmaville storyline. Roger, Workman, I refuse to call him Roger Linus. He's only ever Roger Workman for me. Like, Roger Workman. Is like a featured player in that whole season. So, you know, and like stumbling upon this, like this is a crime scene. Like this is a, a patricide crime scene that they have stumbled upon that they're just like chilling around and like, and you, like this episode seems so wholesome and happy, but it's got this like really dark just thing at the center of it, you know?
It's the only body Ben just left out there to rot.
I mean, I love that.
Because he just hated him so much. But yeah, we're going to come back to Roger Workman and we're going to come back to Van. And we also have a note here to say Jackless episodes are my favorite. That sounds like Joanna.
That's me. Okay.
Yay.
So, like, if you, I mean, I honestly do think we already tried to do this in the storm, but like, if you had to like round up a top five episode, quick and dirty list right now, what would it be? And mm-hmm. I will give you time. I will talk about mine to give you time to come up with yours. Does that sound like fair trade off?
Yeah.
Okay. We've only hit one of mine so far and it's this episode. The Constant, which is a Desmond mm-hmm. episode. I don't think there's hardly any Jack in that episode because it's all like freighter stuff and flashback stuff. And Jack isn't on the freighter at that point. So I think there's barely any Jack in the Constant. I'm sure there's some. I'm sure he's doing some shit with like a sat phone and whatever on the island. But like for the most part, that's just like Desmond and Saeed and Faraday and stuff like that. Okay. LaFleur, which is the Sawyer flashback episode. And for Dharmaville. And you get Jack right at the end. And like the great thing about the appearance of Jack in that episode is like, here's Jack and Kate here to fuck everything up. We were doing so well. So that's that one. Ab Eterno, which is the Richard Alpert backstory episode. Having gone through the whole thing twice in the last, like, you know, since we started this podcast, that episode really, gets me. And then the finale of this. Oh, and there's zero Jack in Ab Eterno. And then, the finale of this season, which is a Jack episode, a very, very much a Jack episode.
Mm-hmm.
That's on my
list. Is that Through the Looking Glass?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's my five, but it's just like, it's very little, it's a minimal Jack. So.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm the same way in that the closest Jack gets to like my top five would be, and these aren't even necessarily Jack episodes. It's like Man of Science, Man of Faith, which technically is a Jack episode. But it's about other stuff too. Mm-hmm. The pilot, which is sort of a Jack episode, but I still think is really good. And then the finale, which we watch, which I think is also not entirely a Jack episode, but it's very Jack centric. I think that's the closest. The mid season or like, you know, non bookend Jack episodes are the ones that really bother me. Cause it's like, every single one of them that we've watched so far, I've been like, God, they really could have just picked a different character and this would have worked out so much better. Cause it's right. Like, I don't dislike Jack and he has a ton of value as a character because he's a doctor. He's a pain in the ass. He's a foil for like six different people. And he's part of, you know, I guess a pretty interesting love triangle, quadrangle square, love square.
Ooh,
I guess.
Love square.
Right? That's what the four of them are? Sure. Sort of a love square.
Love kite.
But yeah, I mean, I also don't, it's funny, because like, you know, we have, I've seen a lot of folks, especially on our live watches, you know, rag on Jack a lot. And I kind of think that's how Lost wanted it. Well, maybe not how they wanted it, but that's how they use Jack. Like, Jack is sometimes the one who, you know, sucks. And somebody's got to suck sometimes in order to get you to the place, like, where you need to be. You know, you need someone who's a little bit of a pain in the ass or, like, throws wrenches in plans for other characters and, but is also a doctor. So, I don't know. Yeah, I think I agree in that the only good Jack episodes are the ones that aren't totally about Jack. And the rest of them are not great.
I don't disagree, and I think my highest ranking, like, Jack episode would be probably, like, the... I mean, it's not a his episode, but the most involved Jack is in my top episodes is probably the incident. But at that point, Jack on Island is closer to his finale Jack than he is to this season three Jack, where he's, you know, already a believer in the island. He's already open to a lot more stuff than this Jack would be. So the latter season, after Jack gets back to the island, he stops bothering me, but also the show stops putting him so in the spotlight. So I'm with, like, latter season Jack, I'm okay with, just as sort of like, as he slowly transitions and learns how to, like, let go and live for the island. I think it works for some reason. I recall it working. It'll be interesting to see if it works on our next time through.
Is Through the Looking Glass the end of this? Is that where we get the flash forward?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he's got a beard and he's like, we have to go back.
Bearded Oxycontin.
Honestly,
Jack.
That one's peak Jack for me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why it's on my list for sure.
Yeah.
I will say that, like, probably in my top, this is my top five, probably in my top 10 is another Jack episode, which is The Lighthouse, which is, where we get David Shepherd, his, like, flash sideways son. That episode wrecks me. I love that Jack episode. But as Dave said, that's, like, Jack on his path to being, like, his better self. Who we also meet in the finale, which is on Neil's list. So anyway, that's just, like, it's just interesting to me because, like, as much as Jack is subject to conversation, as much as Jack is the lead, like, without question, the lead of this ensemble show, he's just not pivotal to my foundational enjoyment of the show. And that's not me being anti-Jack. That's just me just being like, okay, well, that's just, like, not, you know, what I'm looking for in a Lost episode necessarily. And that's interesting. How strong the show was outside.
Right.
Yeah.
The strength of the show is that you don't need Jack to be everything.
Exactly. It's a fantastic story world. Yeah. Like, you can't tell the Harry Potter story and not be in Harry Potter's perspective most of the time, or at least people think you can. And that's, like, a weakness. It's a weakness that you could be like, oh, all the Jewish Hogwarts wizards were over here off camera. Like, that's a weakness in storytelling.
Right.
So the fact that, like, the protagonist of the pilot slowly recedes just to become another member of the ensemble and then peaks right for the finale, is just really smart. Smart use of your storytelling.
The other, and this like feeds into this other thing that I want to talk about, which is like the other thing that makes Lost so successful is that, yes, Jack becomes the new Jacob. Yes, Jack is the big, like, heroic martyr of the island, saving things, blah, blah, blah. But he's not the guy. The guy is Hurley. And that's one of Lost's, like, biggest stroke of genius. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the opposite of Bran is the king. It's how it feels to have Hurley be the new protector of the island. And, like, this episode, is just the best case for putting Hurley in that role, because what Hurley does for Charlie, for Jin and Sawyer, you know, is like the better version of what a Jacob might be, right? This just like positive, like, let's just do the work and then feel rewarded in our work together. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's kind of funny. It's kind of like, the conversation we had with Diana when we were talking about X-Men for Phil's, like, the first time. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about how she loved Charles in X-Men First Class because he's, like, a really great life coach. He just goes around and tries to make sure that everybody, like, is trying to do their best and feels confident and, you know, has someone to talk to. And that really does feel like, you know, that's Hugo's strength on the island, is that he is there to, he's there to make the best out of whatever situation is happening. And I think that, we'll get there, but it's such a brilliant move at the end, you know, cause you really do, you think it should be, you know, they lead you down the path that it should be Jack, and for it to not be Jack in that way is great.
But not even in a way where like it feels like they're trying to be like, whoa, yeah, clever twist or whatever.
Like in a net, like that, yeah, scene where Jack hands it off to him is just incredible. I mean, that's a good Jack moment right there, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm. Dave, do you have any thoughts about that, about Hurley and his Jacobness and
Hurley protagonist chicken?
Yes. No, I agree with all of that. If there was a god, it'd be nice if he was nice.
Yes.
Right? Like, put somebody in charge?
I believe in non-denominational fries, so that's fine.
That's correct. Stay away from my fries.
can I share one more thing that I probably could have said in the calm, but I'll put it here in the storm?
Sure.
This episode of Lost reminds me so much of one of my favorite sequences in all of cinema, which is the retarring of the roof in Shawshank Redemption, right? Because they retar the roof, and Andy Dufresne has explained to some of the guards how he can help them like cheat the tax code or whatever, and so they decide to, you know, give him a reward in return. He says, "All I ask is 3 beers apiece for each of my coworkers. I think a man working outdoors feels more like a man if he can have a bottle of suds. That's only my opinion." You know, and then they all drink their cold bohemian style lager on the roof. But Andy just like basks in the joy of his friends and being able to like bring a piece of normalcy to this like bug shit existence that they are like trying to struggle through. And that's what Hurley does for these guys in this episode, is like just bring a piece of like, we're just guys. I mean, I don't mean to be like gender normative about it, but like, we're just like some bros working on a car in our driveway with some beer. That's what we are, you know?
Right. Well, and you contrast that with all the other people at the camp who are like, it just doesn't seem like they are acting like they've been on the island for 76 days, you know?
Yeah. I don't know what
they're out of cereal.
They're like cleaning up the kitchen and worried about where the cereal went. And it's like, you guys either need to be a little bit more panicked about still being on the island or seeking some sort of happiness like Hurley, you know?
Weren't you fuckers building a church?
Right. Well, there's just a lot. I've seen a lot of complacency here. Yeah.
It's still like, it could be a building. Just like, get rid of tarp life slowly. Joanna needs them to make gloves.
That kitchen, the kitchen situation.
The galley.
It's probably the galley. Yeah. It's just a bug magnet, man, in this jungle.
Neil, next week, what are we investigating on Lost?
We are going to enter 7-7 with Saeed. This is actually, it's interesting because we have now reached a point where I don't think I've watched much further than this since my first watch. And, just sort of like, I think I got to Trisha Tanaka when I was watching ahead. I don't know, earlier this year, late last year, as we were rolling through season 2. So I don't actually remember what this episode is about, but it is a Saeed episode, and it's, you know, it's probably very good.
Well, so we'll see. Storm, so I can say something, right?
Yeah, you can tell me what it is.
Meet
I just
Kyle,
don't remember.
Meet Kyle.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Meet Kyle.
Yeah, I feel like season 3, there's something in every episode going forward. Even exposé.
Well, yeah, exposé is, I guess, the, you know, whatever. Anyway, but, yeah, this is the, I believe this is the flame station, and Mikhail and Miss Clue comes back and, all that sort of stuff. And you find out that it's a bad idea to lie to Saeed. That's just a true fact.
As if we didn't know already. I always suspected.
This is, it's also another, I mean, sorry, I don't mean to like burn next week's pod, but it's also just like one of my favorite, I never get tired of Rousseau doing this. Oh yeah, I'm not going in there. Classic Rosomu, and she pulls it hardcore. They like find the PlayStation. She's like, oh yeah, I'm not going in there.
Yeah, I'll be out here.
No, no, thank you.
So until next week when we get to finally meet Mikhail, where can people find more of your work online, Mr. Neil Miller?
Well, you can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects at one perfect shot. All those things are happening. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast, where we'll have the Jungle of Kistery poll and gifts of Hurley and happiness all week.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I'm also doing another podcast right now called Truth Versus Hollywood. This week we are on Zodiac. Zodiac Part 2 is this week. So go check that out with Dave Chen.
Oh, that one's about one of the senators here in Texas.
You guys solve it, don't you? That's
Ted,
what happens
Ted
this week.
Cruz is a Zodiac killer.
It's about Ted Cruz, yeah.
The Ted Cruz biopic. No, it's what's funny, what I found out while watching Zodiac for that episode is that I had never watched Zodiac all the way through. I had spun out halfway through. It's a long one.
It's long.
It's a long one.
It is. It is.
But it's very, very good, and I was glad to finish it. But I was like, oh, hey, I never actually finished this movie. So there you go. You know, a nice Bay Area gem. Zodiac.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I'm just learning. I could have told Joanna Robinson years ago that Zodiac ends with them catching the Zodiac killer, and she would have just believed me. You could follow me on Twitter at DA70. I do another podcast called Fighting in the War Room. It's about pop culture and parenting at this point. But good news. There are good movies out again. So we do review some movies. Check that out wherever fine podcasts can be found. And I will, of course, be here every week to talk about an episode of Lost and to remind you to not fall down.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.